As we deepen the stillness within ourselves and then within our community here, this is the third day. As we deepen the silence within ourselves, but also among each other, things become more apparent. I don't know if you've noticed. You maybe notice things that you don't notice otherwise. There's space to feel things, to realize things, to meet things. Even it can be just something really what you consider not very important. And so as we do this, then I come back always to, so what is the point? What are we doing here? And for myself, I often come back to that regularly, almost every sitting period. And particularly in a situation like this where we've gathered together, I have gathered you all together, and I have a responsibility to maintain this sacred space, this sacred meeting that we have. And so I keep questioning myself, what is it, what is it, what is it, what is it? Now I have a long 30-year practice of koans, of asking that, so it comes maybe more easily to me because it's just something that I have completely integrated. But it was also what brought me to the practice, was this question. Actually, it was, who am I, as you know, but that's just a different version of what is it. So this questioning comes very naturally to me. I think to all of us, if we allow it to arise, it is quite natural to all of us. Maybe not in the same words, but wondering about the meaning of things, wondering about the point of things, wondering about our own existence, wondering about what our life is about. We have these questions in different formulations. If we allow them to arise, because if we allow them to rise, then it's a bit frightening, because that may put into question everything we believe. We may have this idea that, okay, so I'm a lawyer and I want to rise up to the top of my firm, or I want to become a celebrated orator in front of the court, or I want to, you know, help the working people to, you know, have their rights respected, whatever it is. I'm just picking this randomly as a lawyer. But, and if you start questioning, well, what is the meaning of my life, or who am I, that might shake up some of those firm positions we have of what we think is the point and what we think we want. And one does not discount the other. So you can absolutely have this firm conviction that you're going to defend the working people's rights and see that the labor codes are respected, and also delve into, who am I? one does not mean that we can't do the other. So, if that is what we've come here to do, that's what we do on our cushions, just breathing, just arriving, just sitting, just breathing, and then observing what arises. That's really the royal entrance right there. Because then, as I said, the stillness develops, the silence develops, the space widens, and we have more access to what arises. We have a different presence with what arises, let's say. And as you know, my Dharma name is Tue Sala, which means you are that in English. And it's from the Sanskrit, which is Tat Vam Sami, and Ma Asi, Tat Vam Asi. And it's from the Upanishads, which is a text that is before Buddhism. Very ancient text. I'm not sure exactly what century it is. Does anyone know? Upanishads, wouldn't it? No? I don't know. But it's pre-Buddha, anyway. And from in what is now India, which was a very fertile ground. Asia was very fertile ground because at about the same time there was Lao Tzu, there was Confucius, a lot of great thinkers and deep spiritual practices at the time. And this phrase, you are that, comes from a story of a father and his son. And when his son got to be a certain age, probably 16 or something, the father said, you know, all of us need to go out and find our way in the spiritual world, and so you need to go find a teacher and look into what is your life, or something like that, the spiritual path. So the son did that, and he found a teacher, and he stayed away for 12 years. And he came back to his father, and his father said, so what, you know, did your teacher introduce you to the true essence, the true nature of things? And the son said, well, maybe he didn't know about that because he didn't introduce me to that. And the son said, Father, you know, please teach me, tell me. And so the father tells him, first thing he says is, he says, if you take a piece of clay, and if you really know the piece of clay, then you will understand, you will know the essence of all clay. Argile. Clay is argile. Yeah. He said, if you take a piece of gold and you truly penetrate the true essence of that piece of gold, you will truly penetrate all gold. They may appear differently, the pieces of gold, but the essence will be the same. And he goes on with different examples like this. And the son questions him, I forget exactly what. And each time he says to him, when he questions him, he says, the father says, you will get to the essence of the gold. And he says, Tat Vam Asi. You are that. So you get to the essence of the gold, you are that. You get to the essence of the clay, you are that. And then he goes through various things. And finally, the son really doesn't understand. And he said, bring me a fruit from the banyan tree, which is right there. So it was like, you know, bring me that. Lisa brought me yesterday a passion fruit from the tree up there somewhere. Or we have these amazing fruits that we eat every morning. So bring me the strawberry. Or bring me the orange. Or we have a koan. Bring me the peel of the orange that you ate yesterday, right? Bring me the lemon, whatever. So we could do it here too. Bring me the grape. So he does. He brings him the fruit of the banyan tree, and he says, open up the fruit. And he opens up the fruit, and he said, what do you see? And he said, well, I see seeds. And first he, you know, he says something like, you see that tree? And he says, yes. And then you see the branch? Yes. And you see the fruit? Yes. And he brings the fruit and he opens it and he says, what do you see? And he said, the seed. And he said, if you penetrate to the essence of the seed, you have the tree. If you penetrate to the essence of the tree, you have the seed, you have the sky, you have all of the elements, whatever. You are that. For each thing he does, and ultimately it's with the banyan tree seed that the sun, that's where the story ends, more or less. So what does this tell us? So my teacher gave me this name. And it because it's not I am that, it's you are that, the name that she gave me. So to some extent she gave me this name because I had penetrated to who am I? But there was more to it than that. There was you are that. So that's why she gave me that name. And that's why I am here today. That's why I still do what I do, is because you are that. And I only know you are that because I know I am that. So our practice is about knowing I am that, first of all. We have to go there first. And the teachers, my vow, my job, my occupation of this empty space is so that you can realize you are that. Actually, it's so that you can each realize I am that. But from my position, it's realizing that you are that. So I don't, you know, I could use the banyan tree. I could use the strawberries. I could use the passion fruit, whatever it is. But that's not, that would be copying what, I forget the guy's name, the father's name, did with his son. And he was only responding to the circumstances in which he was in, the father with his son. So I respond, or Joa yesterday responded to the situation in which he was in. With the circumstances, that's what the taking action part we've been talking about is. And yesterday we got really caught up in this, what's the appropriate action? Which is absolutely an essential question. However, today I would like us to come back to what the essential, the really essential question is who am I? And what is it? So we come back to that. Because once we realize that, once we can deepen our understanding of that, then the actions become more clear. And if we haven't truly deepened that, then we continue to struggle, which, and this is not a judgmental position that I'm taking, okay? This is just, it becomes, it's more difficult when we're not clear on who we are, what this is, what the moment is, what the circumstances are, it becomes more difficult to know how to react, how to respond, let's say. And they were really interesting questions that have been coming up about the bees and the mosquitoes and the hamburgers and the cows, and you know, it's just amazing, great questions, so rich. And that was a really rich discussion yesterday. So from, as I said, my vow, you know, that I took when I received my teacher's authorization, when I was recognized as a teacher in this lineage, was to honor that lineage and to honor what that means, to, in my words, it is, like I said, to accompany you all on your paths of awakening to who you truly are. That's my vow. And whatever that involves, I accept to do. Whatever it takes. You know, there were times when I didn't really want to go on retreat. There are times when I really didn't want to sit down and do Dokusan all day long. There may be times when I don't want to eat an oryoki. And this is just the formal stuff, you know. But ultimately, I always do. I always want to. I cannot say that I have ever had a moment where the point was no longer valid for me. If it was, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. So if I didn't, in my flesh and blood, know that you too are that, and that you too can awaken to that, I wouldn't be sitting here. I wouldn't do this. And I am willing to, if I'm willing to sit in this seat, because somebody has to sit here, I'm willing to take that seat, and I'm willing to forego my opinions, my ideas, my concepts, my personal dislikes and dislikes. I'm willing to let go of that, to hold this seat, and be here for this path that we share. Whatever it takes. And I don't know what that will take, I don't know at any moment, none of us do. So sometimes it means introducing a form, sometimes it means getting rid of forms, of all these traditional stuff. Sometimes it means, for me, it meant no longer wearing robes, even though I had worn robes for years and trained in that. And when I first started coming to Portugal, as you noticed in those of you on the WhatsApp group in that 2008 picture, I'm wearing my robes. I'm the only one, but I'm wearing my robes. But at some point I dropped it. I was willing to let go of that idea, that concept of what it meant to wear a robe. And as I've said, maybe at some point I'll let go of that concept of not wearing a robe. For the moment, this is what's true for me. So, I went back and looked at my version, some elaboration of the Suzuki story. But actually what came up when I was looking at those notes I have was that there's another story with Suzuki, which happened at the same time, and it's the same guy who tells the story. This was in the days when they were building the Tassajara Monastery high up in the mountains of California, which Joa has actually been to, which is apparently an absolutely amazing site. Yeah, very isolated, and even now, you know, I don't think normal cars can go there, right? Yeah, you have to go to a place.
Four wheel.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, it's this fabulous site, and they were building it. They were constructing the whole thing, and in the Sangha at the time, there was, you know, a lot of discussion. This would have been probably the late 60s. There was a lot of debate and discussion between vegans, vegetarians, non-vegetarians, non-vegans, sugar, not sugar, all kinds of debate going on. And at one point, the not sugar people won. Debate between sugar and not sugar, right? And so it was decided that nothing would have sugar in it. They would not put sugar in anything. But that they would make it available for people who wanted it. So one day it was really hot, they'd been working all afternoon. The cooks had made lemonade, you know, like fresh squeezed lemon, water, ice cold lemonade. And Suzuki, and they had not put sugar in it, of course, because that was the rule. And so they were standing, a couple of people were standing around drinking it, and Suzuki walked up and they offered him a glass. And he said, they poured it for him and gave it to him, and he said, does it have sugar in it? And they said, no. And there was a sugar bowl sitting there, and he put like 5 scoops of sugar in the lemonade. Drank it with great pleasure. And so it's the same guy telling this story. He tells the lemonade story and then tells the story about actually Suzuki had crushed his finger while moving a boulder and needed to go to a doctor. And it was a long way. They had to go to Carmel. So you can judge how far Tessahara from Carmel is. Or no, maybe it was Monterey.
Well, it's
far, to the nearest town.
It takes 40 minutes to go down.
I think maybe the doctor was in Monterey. So they go to Monterey, long way. This guy drives him there in his truck, and conversation the whole way down, continuing discussion about vegans and vegetarians and sugar and not sugar and the whole thing. I think there were even macrobiotic people involved in this discussion too. And so they go do this, they go to the doctor, and on the way home they were hungry. And I think it was Carmel where they went. At the time, Carmel was not what it is now. You know, it wasn't like chic and fancy, but at the time it wasn't. And there was nothing but like fast food restaurants. And so Suzuki said, let's just pull into this one. So they went to this fast food place, drive-in. You know what a drive-in is? Mm-hmm. In the United States, where you like talk into a little box, and kind of like the drive-thrus they have now, but this is each car has their little box, and you talk, and then they bring it out to you on a tray. And it was a drive-in, and so the guy who was vegan, actually, this guy. And so the only thing he could find to eat was a cheese sandwich, right? Grilled cheese sandwich. The rest of the story is pretty much the same, except that Suzuki takes a bite of his burger and said, this isn't really very good. Can I try yours? And so the guy gives it to him, and Suzuki eats the cheese sandwich. And Trades offers him the cheeseburger, the hamburger with double meat. So then there is no further notice of the guy in his story. He doesn't say whether he ate the cheeseburger or not, but he said from that day on he never thought about his attachment to his food attachments. He never thought about his position about food attachments in the same way after that experience. Now, another story that comes from our more traditional, these are koans that we're talking about, these Suzuki stories are koans, right? One that comes from our traditional line is when the great master Tokusan, who was not yet a great master, but was an expert on the Diamond Sutra. He knew everything there was to know about the Diamond Sutra. And he was from southern China, which was where the very erudite and traditional Buddhism was flourishing. And in the north, they were considered kind of heathens and heretics. They practiced some kind of Zen that, you know, didn't have anything to do with the sutras. And he was going to go to the north. He decided to go to the north and illuminate them and tell them about the Diamond Sutra and everything he knew about it and debate with them and, you know, try to figure out what their position was, but really give them his position. And so he, in those days it was scrolls, and so he carried all these scrolls on his back, in his pack, and he comes to a story, you've heard this many times. He comes to along the road, and there's this old woman selling cake and tea, and she said, you look like you have a heavy load there. And he said, yeah, I'm going to put it down. And she said, so what is it? And he said, it's a Diamond Sutra. She said, where have you come from? And in conversation, you know, travelers exchange. So she knows he came from the south, he's carrying around this Diamond Sutra, what he's coming here to do and everything. And she said, in the Diamond Sutra, it says that the mind of the past is ungraspable, the mind of the present is ungraspable, and the mind of the future is ungraspable. And he said, yeah, it does. He agrees that it says that. And she said, so I have a question, and if you can answer it, I will give you these cakes. You won't have to pay for the cakes and the tea. He said, okay, go ahead. And she said, with which mind, if that is true in the Diamond Sutra, with which mind do you take these cake, cakes and tea? Will you eat and drink this cakes and tea? He doesn't know. He's stumped, as we say. Clueless. And yet he's intrigued by this old lady. And he said, so, you know, how do you, where did you get that question? She said, oh, I've listened to a master nearby here who knows about such things. And so he asks to see the master, and she sends him on his way. So he goes and meets this teacher, this master. And spends like the whole day and the evening like talking about the Diamond Sutra with this guy. Great time, you know, maybe drinking some rice wine and who knows what they're, you know, having a wonderful time. And then the master says at some point, you know, it's getting dark, you probably should go. And they were in the master's hut, and so presumably Toku-san was going to be staying in the monastery with the other monks or something. But he had to leave the master's hut, and so he said, you know, it's time you should go. And so Toku-san agreed and starts to go, and he looks out, and he said, oh, it's really dark, you know. And the master said, oh, yeah, okay. And so he gives him goes to get a candle so that he can walk through the darkness. Brings him the candle, and just as Toku-san takes the candle and is about to turn to go out into the darkness with the candle, and the teacher blows out the candle. And Toku-san, at this moment, of course, has great awakening, sees the light, and goes on to go in front of the assembly the next day, burn all his scrolls, and say he, you know, do not ever be attached to concepts and ideas, I will never do that, and goes on to become a great master who at first is quite ruthless. You know, we have this one about 30 blows. Goes on to become also very, when in his old age, softens and becomes grandmotherly, like we say. We have him in other koans. But always, he is always coming from this place of, once he himself, this teacher, has used a skillful means, as we say, has taken the candle away from him. So that was really kind of a terrible thing to do. How was the guy going to see to go to find his way on the path, right? That was like ruthless, right? The old lady, like saying, you can have these tea and cakes if you can answer this question, and he can't answer it, so he doesn't get the tea and cakes. You know, these are like not like nice things to do to somebody, right? And then he becomes this like really hard line. If you answer, I'm going to give you 30 blows. If you don't answer, I'm going to give you 30 blows. You know, it's like, wow. And then he softens. But every time we meet him, he has a different skillful means that he uses. And in the final one, when we meet him, when he becomes very old, he comes down to with his bowls to go to Orioki. And the cook sees him arriving and says, what are you doing? It's not time to eat yet. And Toku-san says, oh, is that so? Okay. And turns around and goes away. Goes back up to his lodging or whatever. Goes back to his room. But the cook thinks, wow, this is great. I got the old man. I found him doing something wrong. And so then tells this to his Dharma brother. When these are the famous Ganto and Seppo, two Dharma brothers. And Ganto sees that Seppo doesn't get it, doesn't see that Toku-san was just responding to the situation. Okay, it's not time to eat. Goes back. Who knows if Toku-san was doing this intentionally, to come early. We don't know that. Doesn't matter, right? And so Ganto then, another skillful means, says to his Dharma brother, the old man, you know, he may have practiced all these years, but he still hasn't gotten the last word of Zen. And Seppo thinks, oh yeah, this is great, we got him. You know, we caught him out. The next day, the master, Toku-san, hears about this, calls Ganto to come and says, so what is this about? You don't approve of me or something, you know? And Ganto whispers something in his ear. It's whispered so that we don't hear it, so that we can also benefit from this koan. If we knew what Ganto said, then it would change the story, right? So we don't know what he said. He whispers it in his ear. And maybe he also whispered it because there were other people around. I don't know. So the next day, time for the Dharma talk. Toku-san comes to the rostrum like this. You know, he has his table and everything. Comes up there. Doesn't say anything. And goes down. Oh, no, that's not true. He says something. We don't know what he says. That's true. We don't know what he says. He goes down. And the story goes, sure enough, the talk that he gave was unlike any other. Like a talk that had never been heard before. And Ganto then comes forward and, you know, claps and says, ah, it's true, the old man has still not grasped the last word of Zen. So what does this mean? So I'm just telling you this, Toku-san, having realized something by having the light blown out, the guy realizing something with the cheese, with the sandwich and the burger, the Toku-san kind of realizing something with the old lady withholding the cakes, Seppo, I don't think, because Seppo comes later and we get his realization later, I don't think he realized something there. But Toku-san was making his point when we say, his talk was like no other. What does that mean? Like a talk that had never been heard before. And what does it mean, the last word of Zen? When I first heard this koan, when I heard my teacher talking about this koan, it was in a retreat like this. And it was like, you know, probably 2 weeks into a month-long retreat, and I heard it. And it drove me out of my mind for 2 weeks. Trying to get what was the last word of Zen. And why was that talk different than the other talks that had been given before? And absolutely drove me out of my mind. To the point where, you know, I'm kind of embarrassed to say it, but I actually said to my teacher, she knew I didn't mean it, but I will give you my two children if you will tell me the answer to this. And I should not have been working on this koan. I was not that far into the koan curriculum to be working on it. But that doesn't matter. If it grabs you, that's your koan. You know? And so she accepted that, okay, she accepted to let me work on that koan. She didn't want to take my children. She surely didn't want my children. Drove me out of my mind. And I have kind of an obsessional personality, so I was obsessed with it. And I'm grateful for her for not telling me. I am grateful for Ganto for having whispered to Toku-san. Because when I finally managed to get it, as we say, when I realized it, it was unlike if someone had told me it, right? Because if someone had told me that, it would have been a concept, it would have been an idea, it would have been, oh, yeah, right, okay. Okay, yeah, I get it. But it would have been an idea. Whereas my teacher leaving it with me to hang in the wind, you know, on a thread by my teeth, was really a compassionate action. Deeply compassionate. Because it would have been almost criminal to tell me. It would have deprived me of my own experience. And so, you know, I vow to you that I will never tell you the last word of Zen. Ever. Never. Never. And I will never tell you who you are. Ever. However, I will constantly, endlessly, tirelessly accompany you until you do it, until you experience it, whatever it takes. I'm not saying, you know, I'll make you eat a cheeseburger if you don't want to. Well, and Suzuki didn't make him eat that burger, actually. He did not make him eat it. And he didn't make anybody else take the sugar. He was like giving of himself, yes?
You won't say to anybody who he is, but you will say, you said already, that's what you are, that's who you are. That's your name, no?
Yeah. Yeah. But what does that mean for you? Yeah. What does that mean for you? You. I mean, that's the thing. And the thing is, you know, it is criminal in a sense to, I say criminal, to say it, but at the same time, if you haven't fully realized it yourself, it doesn't really mean the same thing.
And you write the name on the record?
I write my name, and I also write their name, not yours, I didn't. On that one I did, yeah. And actually, all of your names are the same as mine. They are who you are, you know? We all are the same name, in fact, you know. Or what, you know, it's interesting in Judaism, you know, it's God is that which cannot be named, you know. That's beautiful, actually. And even in Islam, with, you know, you can't, it become completely perverted, this idea of not an image of Muhammad, but it's the same thing. You know, we can't possibly... We have like these images of the Buddha, but that's not the Buddha. And so any image you have of Muhammad, that's not Muhammad. Any name you give to God, that's not God. As long as we hang on to our concepts, then that is Muhammad, and then we can't do it anymore, you know? Or that's not the way we want Muhammad to look. Or... that Buddha statue is not real, or all of the endless things we do when we start conceptualizing. And now, you know, since I've been talking, I can't even remember why I brought these things here. But I did say to Lisa, I even got the Wi-Fi code so that I could, you know, access something from my cloud that is on this iPad. And now I'm kind of really, oh no, I know, I remember what it was. Now I remember what it was. It has to do with the same thing. I don't really want to go like as late like we've been doing. Okay, so we have a little time. So it does actually, it does have something to do with the rest of it, what I was going to do here. The notion being, having to do with who am I, and the concepts we have, and then the skillful means we might have, and what we think of as skillful means. Come on, baby. Go on. It's not responding to my touch. Oh, it's already on. That's why it's not responding to my touch. So we have this koan that is the first one in the Heikigun Roku, the Blue Cliff Record. It also appears elsewhere, and it's the story of Bodhidharma coming to meet the emperor, right? And the emperor is this guy who has done amazing things to help establish and maintain the Buddhist practice and tradition in China. And he's, you know, funded monasteries and temples, and, you know, supports artists who make beautiful tapestries and statues, and helps feed communities and all kinds of things. And he asks Bodhidharma, first of all, well, what benefit do I get from that? What is the merits of what of all of this that I'm doing? And Bodhidharma says, there is no merit, no merit, no merit to it. So he's like pulling out this rug of conceptual merit from under the all of the ideas the emperor has are suddenly, well, then why am I doing this? You know, well, what's the point then if I don't get any merit from it? And so the emperor says to him, what is the ultimate meaning of the holy truth? Meaning, you know, what is the ultimate meaning of these teachings then? Of these sacred teachings, what is the meaning if what I'm doing has no merit? Bodhidharma, always radical, says vast emptiness, nothing sacred, nothing holy. In this version, it's vast and void, no holiness. So, okay, what does that mean? You know, who is this guy telling me that nothing is sacred and saying that everything is empty? And so the emperor says, well, who are you facing me? He had brought Bodhidharma here to meet him because he had heard about Bodhidharma. And that people had said, you know, he's the guy who's like really doing these amazing teachings and bringing something new to China, and the emperor wanted to meet him. But so now he's saying, well, who are you? Who are you facing me? And Bodhidharma says, I don't know. I know not. Bodhidharma has even taken away all concept of me, you, identity, not identity, all of us, Buddhists, not Buddhists, monasteries, not monasteries. He's like pulled it all out. I don't know. He's pushing him into this not knowing. And the emperor didn't understand. So finally Bodhidharma goes away, crosses the Yangtze River, which I imagine is like some border of going into the wilderness or something. Later the emperor asked his assistant, do you know, later he asked his assistant about this, and the assistant said, do you know who that man was, or is? Do you know who he is? And the emperor said, I don't know who he is. And the assistant said, he's the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, transmitting the seal of the Buddha's mind. So this is just another way of saying, you know, he's the manifestation of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. He's the embodiment of these teachings. And the emperor immediately regretted what had happened and sent off someone and wanted to send someone to go after him to bring Bodhidharma back, to make amends, right? And the assistant said, Your Majesty, don't try to send someone to get him. Even if all the people in the land were to go after him, he would not return. So again, this is like, you know, Toku-san's talk was like no other. Bodhidharma would never return. Even though he's this most powerful emperor of the land and he sends all the armies to get him, to bring him back, he will never return. And this koan is, so we work with this koan, right? The later research, and I've said this before, later research has revealed that actually the daughter of the emperor went after, followed him, followed the Bodhidharma, and became one of his successors, actually. Although, because women were not paid any attention to or recorded, you know, maybe that old lady with the tea cakes was some great, great teacher in the tradition, and we don't know because nobody cared. It was just some old lady selling tea cakes, right? So the Dharma, the emperor's daughter goes off and becomes a successor. Well, nobody recorded it. But she actually figures in other stories we have. Anyway, so the reason I present this story is because, so this, Bodhidharma is using his skillful means as well. He's not, you know, he could be caught up in, oh wow, the emperor is this great thing. I have to be, you know, really respectful. I have to be careful. What do I say to him? And yet, Bodhidharma with Avalokiteshvara, great compassion, takes everything away from him. And we say that, you know, there's a Zen saying of, you know, a true master is free to give and take life. And I used to, when I heard that, and I frequented my teacher, and then sometimes my teacher's teacher, Genpo Roshi, I used to feel like he was in the taking away life and she was in the giving of life. And there is some truth to that, but what do we mean by, and sometimes it's free to kill and give life, so what does that mean to kill in this context? I really felt like he was, Genpo Roshi was like, you know, killing, taking away, whereas Genpo Roshi was giving me everything. And I even said that to both of them, that I felt that way about them. So when we say killing in this context, it's not literally killing, or when we say to kill the Buddha, like someone brought up yesterday. In this context, it's like, it's taking, you know, like depriving the student of their cherished concepts, right? So we have these things we cherish and we hang so tightly to, or like Bodhidharma, depriving the emperor of his concept of generosity, what it means to be generous and then receive something in return, accomplishing something, even his concepts of what the teachings are about. And by doing so, that helps the person die, right? Die to the small self, to their idea about themselves, and then to be brought to the great life of freedom, the great freedom of living life fully, totally, being who you truly are. So it seems another Zen paradox of killing is actually giving life. And actually the teacher, by sending us to sit on the cushion, is asking us to sit and forget ourselves. It's already depriving you of what you would be doing out there in daily life. You know, like Lisa, we were talking earlier, and so here I am like plugging in the Wi-Fi code and looking up on my iCloud and all this stuff. And she said in the first retreat she did, which was a Vipassana retreat, you had to hand over your phone at the beginning of the retreat. They like take even that away from you. The first retreat I did, which was not technically Zen or Vipassana or anything, there were no cell phones in those days, but yeah, I mean, they even, it was in a house and they covered up the books, they took down all the mirrors. There was like real silence, and there were monitors who, if you talked, came to you and reminded you not to speak. And you didn't even, wasn't even like with Orioki where you can see what's being served and you tell them to stop. It was mealtime, you arrived and there were plates and you just had to take the plates. You didn't even get to choose what you wanted on that plate or not, or how much. So all of this is what we call skillful means. Upaya, as we say. And the point of it, so the point of the teacher saying sit down, as it says on our website, the first thing you see when you come to the Wildflower website is sit down and wake up. Because that's what the point is. Sit down. Cut off the roots of your delusion, you know, by just sitting and forgetting yourself. So that you can then wake up to you are that. So now if we, you know, so Bodhidharma, I'm looking what I wrote down this about this Bodhidharma thing. Right, so in this Bodhidharma situation where he says you can never bring him back, if we see that, you know, kind of like the true nature, the true essence doesn't come and go. So there's nothing to bring back, nothing coming or going. You know, it's like the quote we had of someone saying, you know, in the beginning nothing arises, in the middle nothing stays, in the end nothing goes. Because nothing does come and go. It's just the true nature, of course thoughts come and go, breath comes and goes, but the true nature, the true essence does not come and go. And by observing the coming and going of thoughts, breath, feelings, whatever, by observing that coming and going, we then settle into what does not come and go. That's the whole point of sitting here, doing this. And everything, all of the rituals, you know, you could say like all of the rituals, me, everything is just an extension of the teaching of that basic point. So, of helping us to awaken. And you know, traditionally in the traditionally in Zen, when you make the engagement with you, when you engage, you say, I want to be your student, and the teacher says, okay, I accept you as my student, and you do this little ceremony, and there's a little exchange that we do around it. Traditionally in that saying, the teacher says, by doing this, you accept to have me kill you. Which in the traditional Zen talk and jargon and in a traditional setting, probably people didn't even blink about that, you know. In our setting, people do. They have a problem with that. So personally, I phrase it differently when I present it. But the meaning is the same. It's the same thing. It's the same vow that I take, and it's the same vow that the person, the student, agrees to. So what are we talking about when we say free to kill and give life? That's what we're talking about. And anything else is an aberration. Now, yesterday we got into this thing of, you know, like, you know, it's right or wrong to kill cows and mosquitoes and wasps and all of this. No, that was the day before the wasps, I think, wasn't it? No, yeah. It was the mosquitoes yesterday and the cows and extending to all, you know, sentient beings and all of that. So, and there's an element in this of trust and doubt. You know, we say in Zen, like Joe even said yesterday, great doubt, great awakening. So, small doubt, small awakening. But that also, doubt and trust are linked in this. Right? And I once was in a retreat with my teacher, but also my teacher's teacher, who, and I was in a phase of great doubt, which you may have heard me talk about before, when I couldn't even bow, I couldn't even chant this stuff. It was just like, made me throw up almost. And I was already a teacher. I had only received transmission like a year before. And I just couldn't do it. And so my Genpo, my teacher's teacher, said to me, so doubt it. Doubt it. Go into it. Doubt it. Doubt all of these forms. Doubt your transmission. And therefore, if you doubt your transmission, doubt your teacher. If you doubt your teacher, doubt me. That was an easier one to do. doubt it all. Doubt everything. You know, doubt that the grass is green. It was in the middle of winter on an island in the North Sea. So that was kind of a hard one to do because there was no green grass.
Doubt the idea of doubt as well.
Exactly. Exactly. Doubt it all. And wow, that was an extraordinary practice. But again, like I said, you know, I have this obsessional personality. So when I get something like that, I just like go with it. Which is why I'm sitting here and what I do with all of you. The obsession manifests in a different way, but I am as equally obsessed with each of you and your paths. So I'm not going to let you go. So in order to really then, to really, like, so the guy, you know, the teacher eats the burger and the cheese sandwich, or, you know, he can, I hope for him, and he said he did, he let go of some of his attachments about his position of food, right? So I hope that for him, he was able to not, you know, not go into judging Suzuki and what he did and all that, but to go into how he was feeling about it and what it meant for him. You know, like Joe said yesterday, this perplexed, I don't know who came up with that word of perplexed, but so go into that. That has meaning for you, that perplexity. Go into this rejection, you know, like the emperor did with Bodhidharma. You know, he was like, what? What? How can you say this to me? And then who are you? And then when the guy says to him, it's the Avalokiteshvara, and then he's like, ah, bring him back. He's like, and then he's probably, I hope for the emperor, that he looked into what he was feeling around all of that. And because that's where the path is. It's only you who can wake up. The teacher is there to like throw these things at you or pull these things out from under you, but only you can wake up. So how does that feel when it's pulled out? How does it feel when something is thrown at you? I don't throw things at you, I hope, but maybe figuratively, maybe not literally, but figuratively. And that, you know, so how does that feel? How does it feel when it's pulled out? You know, like we all had the rug pulled out when we came here. How does that feel? What happens? What happens when you sit there on your cushion and you just breathe? How does that feel? What is that? What comes up? And if you do that, and you trust what comes up from you there, and you trust it, and you really go into it, then something else will happen. And ultimately, then, you gain trust. If your teacher knows that and has experienced that, and your teacher trusts you, then the teacher will trust where you go on your path. Even if it means you go away, you know. And there are people who have gone off and done other things. I saw this with my own teacher. And sometimes they come back, sometimes they don't. But whatever happened, I know she trusted that that was their way. And I do too. You know, there are people who I've given Jukai to and who I don't see anymore. Even if we, you know, made our vow together, I'm still, for me, that is their path, and I'm still accompanying them, however needs to be accompanied, you know. Maybe they don't even think about me, but that's okay. That's their path, and I trust that that's their path. And if you can, what's important for me is that they trust themselves. And if that means not trusting themselves sometimes, or not trusting me, or not trusting the path, or not trusting the teachings or something, then that's okay. As long as they trust themselves, that's what's important. And that's where the doubt comes in, that's where... and Tokusan acts from that space, Suzuki Roshi acts from that space. Suzuki Roshi is not telling people they should eat meat or not eat meat or eat sugar or not eat sugar. He's just trying to shake them free of their fixed positions and their kind of dogmatic way of being, and then saying these people are right and these people are wrong. Same thing with the cat. Yesterday there came up the story of killing the cat. Well, the thing with the cat was there was a dispute between the east and the west wings of the monastery about the cat. And so the teacher said, well, if somebody can say, you know, a true word about the cat, then we can save the cat. They didn't. He killed the cat. It doesn't mean he killed the cat like you think it means he killed the cat. Okay? Like, everybody has this idea, like, you know, slicing the cat's throat or something. That's not what it is. That's not what it is. But that's another koan in our story, in our curriculum, so I'm not going to tell you what it is. So, let's open it up. Do we have any time for questions?
10 minutes, I think.
Okay, so we'll open it up, comments, questions.
I was imagining you talking with artificial intelligence in the future. When you open your laptop, it came to my mind the idea of artificial intelligence. And if you in the future can have sit with the artificial intelligence and share this Dharma talk with it.
What do you mean, like...
The implication of it.
So you mean if... sometimes people say that, you know, your phones and your... There are... Like, if you're talking about... My daughter told me that, you know, she... Because she's talking about pregnancy all the time. My daughter's pregnant. And so because she's talking about pregnancy all the time, that she feels like she gets this stuff about strollers and baby food and stuff, and that somebody said that your phones are... With Siri and things, they can pick up what you're saying. I'm not saying that my iPad is listening and it's going to, like, bring up something from artificial intelligence. But I'm not... So what do you mean? Like, if I type this into artificial intelligence?
Of, the development of artificial intelligence.
Uh-huh.
The way they interact in a Dharma talk, or the way they respond to your question, who you are.
Or you feed... All of the information,
like,
that is available.
Feed the talk into it, or
feed it into an AI of all the talks, all the texts, all the tradition, and then you have it as a teacher, the AI, and you compare this to.
I mean, you know, I think there are questions about whether that will happen someday, not specifically with Dharma teaching, but with, you know, everything. My experience is that something came up in a talk once, and or a text or something came up, and they put it into AI and asked a question or something, and then something came back and they sent it to me by email and didn't tell me it was from AI, but I could tell. I didn't know it was from AI, but I knew he didn't write that. It was so clear he didn't write it. It was fake. You know, and even though it was like checking all the boxes, there was no heart. And so AI may be able to realize AI's true self, but can never realize your true self, ever, no matter what, you know. No matter how many versions we plug into it, it can never realize who you are. Ever.
The answer is in the name, artificial.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, this is true, yeah. Yeah.
I have a question about the Suzuki story still. Mm-hmm. So let's say that the student after that story would sort of conclude that it's still not right to eat beef, to eat the cow, as it were, yet he questioned himself and he concluded that through a much richer way than initially. Right, so then after much questioning, he still didn't change his belief. What does that mean? Does that mean that we're still clinging or attaching to it? And the opposite, does it mean that the only outcome that would have been successful from a Zen perspective is that if he let go of that belief? Because that means clinging and attachment are finally gone.
So, just to respond to the final part, the only acceptable outcome, no, that is not the only acceptable outcome.
Okay.
Whatever happened is the acceptable outcome. Mm-hmm. So, but that is what happened, so that's the acceptable outcome.
Okay.
I mean, from another point of view, nothing else could have happened because that's what happened.
Okay.
So what was the rest of it? That he... I don't know, and the story doesn't tell if he just said he no longer had the same attachment to his positions around food. It didn't say that he was no longer vegan. Didn't say that. And what happens is, so if he still believes, if he still maintains his veganism, does that mean he's attached to it? No. Not necessarily. Because we can very easily be open to all the vast points of view. And like my niece used to be vegan and she's not vegan anymore. Somebody else wasn't vegan and they are now vegan. I'm essentially vegan, but, you know, I eat fish sometimes, you know. So there's all kinds of different possibilities, and the point is not to be stuck anywhere. It's not to then, you know, have faith in what you feel is right. It just means not to be stuck on that. Then in another circumstance, something else might be right. You know, the Tibetans, we talked about the Burmese yesterday, but the Tibetans, their position has always been they will eat meat if it wasn't killed specifically for them. Well, that too is kind of, it's like the guy who says, I'll eat it if it's offered, right? But when you look at where the Tibetans came from on the high Himalayan plateau, there wasn't really much to eat, you know? And they probably had to eat animals. They weren't attached to, so in this situation, to the same thing in every situation, in other words, say. And the same truth for every person. In every context, it all depends, as we say. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'd just like to share a story because it's weird that the subject is about this subject because I don't eat meat at all for a long since I'm 18, and I was over a friend's house last week and. We stay with her like for a week with my son, and I think she's going through a very hard time, and she had invited she had invited her kids, the three boys, they are like 20, 21 and 22, something like this, and so she never cooked, but she cooked a huge chicken, because her son were coming and they were going to eat a lot, and she was telling me how much they were eating, and we had to make a huge dinner, and so we spent the day cooking for her. We saw it, she was very happy about that, and it happened that the boys, they didn't come. They didn't show up, they didn't appear, they didn't call. So we were just the three of us with this huge table, and there was a huge chicken in the middle, and I said, okay, so I think we, you know, for sure they're not going to show up. It's like 11 at night. They're not going to show up. But we were like starving, and I say, oh, you know, I really think I'm going to eat that chicken. It looks beautiful. And my son, he was like, Mom, are you sure? What are you doing? I mean, he was almost fainting, and I was like, oh, yes, I really want to taste this chicken. That was the only way, you know. There was something so. Tragic, I don't know, maybe tragic is not the word, but I was so sad, you know, my friend. I could see, you know, that was so sad. And I ate the chicken, you know, and the chicken tastes really, I didn't like the taste, but I think I couldn't do anything else. And that was, It was just a situation. I had to eat the chicken. It was the only way to participate to what was happening, you know. And she didn't, because she's she doesn't eat meat, but I ate the chicken. And I think if I had to do it again, I will do it again. And I didn't taste it good at all, but I will do it again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, beautiful story.
I have a story about Bernie Glassman that I think came from Frank. Bernie Glassman, if you didn't know this man, smoked mega cigars and drank beer and ate pizza. That was kind of his, and he was also directly descendant from Maizumi.
He was Maizumi Roshi's first successor.
Jolly guy, all kind of hippy-dippy. And he had this German student who came to him and said, would you trust a Zen teacher who smokes cigars? And Bernie said, no. The guy left. Every time I hear these conversations, I think of that story.
I think they said the time is up.
They're leaving in any case.
Yeah. No, the server's left and someone, I don't know, said it's time. The timekeeper said it's time, so I'm sorry.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. We'll do the four vows quickly.
Delusions are